And I'm very happy and grateful to be here. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Will y'all join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Al Moon has asked me to make a couple of announcements. Admission to our luncheon today will be by badge and for members, and visitors and children will be by ticket. And as I said, I'm very happy to be here. This is I went to my first IDA meeting in San Diego in 1979. I was sober 7 months then. I remember I met Hal M., and he got me in touch with a sponsor in Raleigh, and I've enjoyed a gradual growth and improvement in sobriety ever since, and for that I'm very grateful. You know, I went to that meeting. I went to the CCAD that year and then to the spring meeting in San Antonio that year in 1980. Somewhere during that time, I started hearing I speak. I would hear somebody in the background talking about how much dope to give to a horse, and that caught me. You know, he said a lot of other things. I've heard him several times since, and he says a lot of things I identify with. And if y'all will help me welcome Roger C. from Texas.
My name is Roger, and I'm an addict and an alcoholic. Hi, group. I'm really, really glad to be here. I made my first meeting at the Breakers Hotel in Palm Beach, Florida. I don't know what year that was, about 11 years ago or 10 years ago. 75. John and Joe Flynn and Joe F. and let's see, who else? A couple or three more of us. Where it came to that meeting the first time, for the first time we came to an IDAA meeting, and by God's grace, none of us have had a drink or a pill or gone crazy since, I guess. And I am just extremely privileged to be here. I'm thrilled with little old Al. I still think of him as little old Al. I don't really mean little old Al, but I mean that as being a sweet, young, bright, young gentleman, and don't you agree with that? That guy is just so sharp, and I love him. His daddy and I, John Mooney. John was a guy that I called my doctor sponsor, and I've known John, or knew John, for 20 years, I suppose. Knew him long before I came to IDAA, and I recall seeing John standing up at a podium like this, and I forget what meeting we were at, but about 6 or 7 years ago, and John was telling his story. And I thought, boy, if I could ever get to do that, I just can't believe how neat it would be to get to be a speaker at an IDAA conference. And so I was enthralled with that thought. And here, 5 or 6 or 7 years later, I'm getting to do it. And that's a privilege for me. It's a real blessing. I've been scared to death. Y'all pray for me. I don't know what in the world I'm going to say. I asked Tony a while ago. I said, Tony, I'm scared to death. He said, don't you remember what God said to Moses? And I said, what'd he say? He said, well, Moses said, I can't say that. I can't talk, you know. And God told him, said, I wouldn't ask you to do it if you hadn't been able to do it. So I guess maybe I got something in me that I hope I have. I hope I'm able to say what God would have me to say today. John had me to Blackstone. He had me to Blue Ridge. He had me to St. Simon, some of the most, some of the most beautiful, wonderful AA, I guess, in the world before I came to IDA. And I did not stay sober after that. But I have been sober ever since I found this group of people. And I think that's significant. And I hope that I can say some things today, particularly the new people, that I've learned in this group and experiences that I've had that have helped me stay sober. I hope that I can express that in such a way that it might help you all. What happened to me was the things that... Can I move this? I want to move that. Can I? Thank you very much. Jerry don't like for you to mess with his tools up here. He wants you to stand. Didn't he tell you to stand up and all that? He'll tell you how to talk on this thing. What happened to me? It says in the big book that our stories disclose in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And what happened to me was, I was a student at Texas A&M College. Now, there's not very many Texans here, but in Texas, if you're an Aggie, you're like, you're the brunt of all the sorriest stories they can think of to tell on you. And so sometimes I say that the fact that I became a dope fiend, it isn't related to the fact that I was a Texas Aggie, but there are people that would argue that in Texas. But while I was a student at A&M, I had appendicitis, and I went to the hospital, and they operated on me, and they gave me painkillers, and they did this, and they did that, and I went back to school after about 7-8 days, and I was still hurting, and so they prescribed painkillers for me, and I didn't ever quit hurting, and I get worse and worse, and I kept humping over and humping over. Finally, I went back to Houston. I was at A&M. I went back to Houston. I saw the doctor, and they ran some tests on me. They decided what I had was an abscess, and so they operated on me again. And they put a rubber drain tube in me and messed around, and I was on drugs for a long time. Well, I tried to go back to school, and I didn't quit hurting. And I was raised on a ranch and a dairy farm in Houston. I know some of y'all think I'm from Cambridge, England, the way I talk, but I wasn't a Harvard or an Oxford man, either one. We got them around here. They talk so weird, I can't hardly understand them. But I was out at, and this is a long time ago, you can imagine, because my doctor made a house call on me, a ranch call. Literally happened. I was out there, and I was just hurting and hurting. I was a little bitty boy. I was about 18, 19 years old, and wasn't dry behind the ears yet. And I recall vividly the night this doctor dispensed to me two cc ampules, 50 milligram Demerol, double handful of ampules, and a syringe and needle. And I'd just been a student a little while, but I'd heard the term asepsis, and he only gave me one needle with this syringe thing. I said, "Well, look here, Doc, how am I going to use that thing? It's not sterile." And he said, "Well, hell, you're not giving it to anybody but yourself. You ain't going to catch nothing." Well, I didn't catch nothing catching, but I caught something. What I caught was Demerol addiction, and at the time, Demerol was a non-addicting drug. And we talk about being social drinkers. Well, I guess I was the first social dope fiend that ever happened to Demerol. What happened to me was, they advertise that these drugs are non-addicting. It's my opinion that anything that'll enhance your digestion, regulate your sleep patterns, stimulate and enrich your personality, develop your sex life, aid your interpersonal relationships, et cetera, et cetera. How in the hell would anything like that not be addicting? If you ever, It reminds me of a friend of mine, and if you recall how you used to go to people's houses and you'd always look in their drug cabinet, see what kind of pills they had, huh? Anybody here know what I'm talking about? Yeah, yeah. Okay. Friend of mine, he looking in somebody's drug cabinet, and he saw some lithium pinkum in there. Said, take one pill every 28 days. He said, my God, what a pill. One pill every 28. Well, that's kind of the way Demerol affected me. I just thought, Lord, what a wonderful thing. And I don't think this was because I was sorry, no good, and full of everything. I think that Demerol did exactly for me what Demerol is supposed to do for people. But I think that some people maybe don't like it as well as I did. I really did like it. Another thing that happened in the chain reaction that led to my total addiction, I guess, was that I graduated as a veterinarian and went into practice in Houston, Texas. And I told you I was raised in that little old country place. I didn't drink. I didn't smoke. I didn't even drink coffee. I didn't date. I just didn't do anything for the fun of it when I was a kid. The most fun I ever had was I'd get on a horse and ride to the creek and go swimming naked or something. And I got to college, and there was a lot of new experiences up there. And one of them was, I think it was Miller's High Life Beer. I had a brand new, it's 1948, I had a brand new Ford convertible car. And I go across the river. Seemed like everywhere I was when I was a kid, you had to go across the river to get drunk. But anyway, I'd go over there, and there was an old honky-tonk called a paper moon. And I get over there, and after about two bottles of beer, I didn't know how to dance. I'm telling you, I was a country boy. I didn't know anything, and I didn't know how to dance. I didn't know how to do anything. I drank about two beers, and hell, I thought I was Fred Astaire. And I figured those gals, if they didn't get to dance with me after about two beers, they was missing something. And so I could dance then. This Demerol made me feel that way. Now, after I got out of school, I was still doing this drinking. And I didn't know that I was going to be an alcoholic ahead of time. I didn't know I was going to be a drug addict ahead of time. I want to say to you that I don't believe that the reason we continue to drink and continue to use drugs for years and years and years is the same reason we start out drinking. I don't think we start out drinking because we have a suicide wish or anything. I think we start drinking for the same reason everybody starts drinking. Social drinkers and alcoholics, people say to me, how come you start drinking? I don't know. Everybody was drinking. How come I start drinking? Well, somebody set a can of beer down in front of me and said, try it. Now, I tried it. Well, difference between me and them guys, I guess, is I liked it good. And it did things for me, and I think it does things for everybody. They wouldn't keep paying $30 a quart for wild turkey liquor. A lot of social drinkers like the way whiskey makes them feel. Well, I did. Trouble is, as time went on, it took so much to make me feel like I wanted to feel. By the time I got to feeling that way, I was knee-walking drunk. You know, I was naked and in a pile and in jail and all kinds of sequelae to being an alcoholic. And gradually, through the years, my tolerance level I guess increased, and my amounts increased. And I'd come in from being on one of these bouts, and I was a veterinarian by now, went to Houston. Somebody set a little white poodle up on your table, you know, and your eyes are, you know, and your mind, your eyes have them uncrossed, a bunch of weird things. You reach out there kind of and try to take hold of that little dog, and that scoundrel will bite you, and you bat him off the table. Your bedside manner, you know, is not quite what you... So I had some bedside manner medicine, and I'd always come in the morning, and I needed to level out, right? And I guess I left a piece out of the story. I got... They finally, after four hospitalized times, they got me off of those drugs when I was a junior in vet school. I actually went through withdrawal, but I guess I hadn't crossed that invisible line. I didn't know that I was addicted. In fact, I just didn't believe in addiction for me. Did y'all? When I picked up my first can of beer, took that first shot, I didn't believe in addiction for me. My doctor didn't believe in it for me. He gave it to me. He didn't think I was going to get addicted. I didn't either. It never occurred to me. I just thought I was taking medicine. And I thought I was just taking medicine for a long time. Interesting observation. We've got a lot of anesthesiologists. We've got a lot of psychiatrists. Probably a disproportionate number of us here who are addicted were people who had access, free access to a lot of drugs and who were oriented towards psychotropic medication. You know, a psychiatrist, he take a little old woman sitting way over here in the corner, little bitty gnarled up lady, you know, and she just hates everybody and scared to death. And he throw a handful of psychotropic medication down her, and she turns into a sex maniac. You know, that gives him an impression about what how that neat that medicine might be if he took it. So, you know, life gets hard on a lot of us, and anesthesia, he's standing there, and he gave somebody some medicine. It made life easier on him. Hell, he went through a surgery and didn't even hurt him. He's going through some pain. He's got some of that medicine there. He's thinking, well, yeah, boy, wouldn't that be neat? And plus the availability. Well, you just can't imagine. I heard a guy just saying last night, sorry, I can't remember this guy's name, but he was in Paradise. He said he had the keys to the drug cabinet. Let me tell you something about a veterinarian. You own the whole hospital. And the medicine in there in your drug cabinet, you have done ordered enough medicine for a whole herd of sheep. Man, there's dope everywhere. You buy it by the quart. Can you imagine how much dope it takes to lay a horse down to castrate him? He don't want you to do that, right? Guarantee you, there's enough dope in one dose for a horse to keep you in good shape for a long, long time. There's dope everywhere in a veterinary hospital. If you ever go back shooting dope, that's the thing to get to be as a veterinarian. Yeah, man, that's... I'd come in the mornings from these escapades at night. By now, I was married, and I had a terrible marriage. I was not a happily married man. And I just, you know, I did that twice. By the way, though, there's a lot of us in here hurting. One of the things that I think we have is a common denominator among all of us, but is this terrible low self-esteem. And part of it is because of all the terrible things that have gone on in our lives up until the time we get here. And one of the most tragic things that happened to me was these divorces that I went through and the perceived failure at marriage. Well, I have a wonderful marriage now, one of the best, and I hope I come back to that because I want to really tell you all about that. But the fact that was that I probably wasn't as terrible a husband as I thought I was. What I was a terrible chooser, right? Have you ever, you can fall in love with the wrong person. And if you're not careful, you'll marry them. And a lot of times, you get together, you know, and you think you're in love, and you're not really in love. You're in estrus. That's a... You're sitting on a bar stool one night. Al's little sister told me this. You're sitting on a bar stool one night, you're in a blackout, you don't know who you are. And next morning you wake up and you're married to somebody, I'm not sure that marriage was built in heaven, right? Anyway, I ended up married, and I wasn't happy about it. And the main reason I wasn't happy about it is because my wife didn't love me. A man can buy anything. I guess a woman can too, but a man can buy anything. He can hire somebody to fix his meals. He can hire somebody to wash his clothes. He can hire somebody to clean up his house. You can get somebody to do windows, even commodes. Boy, you can even get your sexual needs met, sort of, for money. But, brother, one thing you can't buy is love. And that's the best thing we need, I think. You know why that's so strong? Because we need to feel like we're lovable. We need to feel worthy. We need to feel like that we're okay, that we're worth being around somebody. And the best evidence you can get that you're worth something is for some human to tell you, darling, I love you. Boy, I got a little old wife now that just, she loves me so good. I can't tell you how precious that is. And I missed that so long. And we need love. That's the most strengthening evidence. You know, don't you even love it if a little old puppy gets up in your lap and licks on you? And you know, you go, dogs love me. Isn't it, right? And old ladies, you know, they come to you, you're the doctor, and they just love you. You know, and that feels good for somebody to love you because it's evidence that you're lovable, that you're worth a damn for somebody. Well, I had two marriages that weren't like that. I had two that weren't like that. First one was pretty rough. The second one was horrible. And this little thing I was married to, she might have been fine, a little wife for somebody else, because maybe she could have found somebody she loved. She didn't love me. And I could touch her, and she'd shake me off and slap me and move, and, you know, she didn't like me. Oh, that broke my heart. I couldn't stand that. I really couldn't stand that. I got a favorite phrase. If you really can't stand it, you ought to change it. You know, the Serenity Prayer says, God, grant me the serenity to accept things I can't change and courage to change things I can change. I think a long time I lived in situations that was just making my life horrible that I could have changed if I'd have had the courage. One of the things I didn't have the courage to change that last marriage, I was afraid I couldn't find anything any better. I'd done tried twice, let me tell you, and sort of tried about 15, 20 times. But let me tell you, an N of 2 is not a very big N. You line up 100 people here, ladies, and go try to think that you're going to get one that's going to be just right for you. I bet you couldn't find 100. Out of 100, I bet you couldn't find one that suits you just perfect. Difficult to find somebody that can love you, that love you like you are, that you don't have to change nothing. They love everything you are. Wouldn't that be neat? It's like being a rose, and you're being a rose, and you're smelling like a rose, and they're saying, I love roses. It's hell to try to be a petunia for somebody when you're a rose. Plus, if you're married to a turkey, I got another comment. If you're married to a turkey, you can do everything. You can hug them just right. You can rub them just right. You can do anything you want to, and all that turkey can do is gobble. I don't care how you act. You can't never get nothing out of a turkey but a gobble. So when you're married to a turkey, you can't change him. Thank God. Thank God there's a way, and I guess Jesus said that he provides a way for us to make those changes. And I didn't know I needed to make that change, but I was having a horrible marriage, and I was drinking a lot, and I was doing a lot of things I was not proud of myself for. And I'd come in the morning, I'd take drugs, and I used every kind of drugs. And in a veterinary hospital, you know, you got every kind. And there's kind to wake you up, and a kind to make you dance, and a kind to make you do this and do that and do that. I took it all. Finally, my drug of choice boiled down to morphine. And I took it intravenously. And after several years, 2 or 3 years, I guess, I was unequivocally addicted to morphine. And meaning that I couldn't go at all without it. And I was not only emotionally and habitually habituated to it, but I was physically dependent on it. I just couldn't operate without it. It was like being just like water. You know, we're addicted to water. It's a good thing it don't hurt us, because we're addicted to it. I'd hate to have to kick my water habit, wouldn't you? But anyway, I had a habit that was just about as strong as a water habit. I couldn't function even physically without that particular chemical. That's horrible. That condemned me to use a chemical that was killing me in order to function. That didn't make sense, did it? That was a mutually exclusive situation. And so finally, I got into the Federal Narcotics Hospital after going to several places. Back then, this has been 25 or 30 years ago, we've got thousands of treatment facilities all over the world. I heard people talking last night about studying addictionology and all this. I think that's wonderful. Back when I was a dope fiend, brother, it wasn't fashionable to be one, and there wasn't no place to go to get any help, hardly. People were trying to help me, but they didn't know what to do about me. Back then, the statistic they would quote to you is that 2% of the people who had what I had were going to live through it. 2%. I went to the Federal Narcotics Hospital. That's what they said. 2%. Boy, that didn't help my self-esteem or my faith or my hope or nothing else. I got real depressed when I went there for help. I said, you guys don't do a very good job, do you? Only 2% of us are and I went to that place, and I stayed 3 months. And I came out, and I got addicted again. And I went back, and I stayed 6 months. And I came out, and I got addicted again. I went back, and I stayed 3 more months, and I came back, and I got addicted again. I could not stay unaddicted. I decided that must be something vitally wrong with me. I decided that maybe I was Freud's cousin or something. I couldn't understand why I couldn't stay off of drugs. And I couldn't stay off of them. And I was so devastated by now. My life was just ruined. My little wife and three kids, they couldn't have anything to do with me. My partner was sick of me. I was messing up so bad, and we had dissolved our partnership. I couldn't be what I'd spent so much time training for. My life was devastated. I was going to amputate my hands one time so that I couldn't take drugs. I was in a drug state then when I made that beautiful decision. But I went down to my clinic, and I put the instruments on. I was going to autoclave my... I didn't want to have any hands, but by God, I didn't want to catch nothing in the process, right? So I don't know why I didn't do that. I guess I got so drunk I couldn't accomplish it. I don't know what happened. Probably burn up the autoclave in the process. But I set out to do that one time. That's how crazy I was. But let me tell you what else I think that indicates. That indicates a strong desire to get over this thing. I had a desire. I just didn't have the mechanism. Motivation is not enough. I bet everybody in here for years was wishing and hoping and even praying that you didn't have to have this stuff no more. I did. I didn't want to be a dope fiend. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I never did want to be. I'm like my one of my sponsors said years ago. He said he didn't know until he took his fourth and fifth step he's the kind of guy you ought not to associate with. Well, I didn't know that about me ahead of time, you know. Another time I took a tremendous dose of overdose of drugs trying to kill myself. Some of y'all have done that. And this wasn't one of these dramatic things that Freud talks about. I really was trying to kill myself. I calculated the dose on what it'd take to kill a horse. I messed up. I didn't calculate what it'd take to kill a jackass. I don't know how long. I really did. I took a tremendous amount of Seconal, and I don't know why it didn't kill me. My tolerance was up, obviously, and a lot of things happened. But you know, and I guess Marilyn Monroe and a few people have taken tremendous overdoses, and then you get this kidney shut down later on. It isn't just the acute toxicity. It's, you know, y'all know what I'm talking about. Anyway, even that didn't happen to me. Thank you, obviously. Thank God. But I really did want to die. You know how come? I couldn't stand being a dope fiend. You know, there's a lot of people out there don't understand us. They think we like to be an alcoholic. Do you know that? A lot of people think you like to be. I even see this happening in treatment centers. You got people and you send them out for a weekend, and they get drunk. Well, you put them suckers on level two, and you know, they can't go to the, you know, just mad and upset. They went right out there and got drunk. It's like somebody having a heart attack. Now, you promised me you wouldn't do that. Can you imagine what this is doing to these kids? There you are, having a convulsion in the floor right in front of our children. You sorry devil. Let me tell you, I think we have a disease. But I think it's treatable. I think we can get in a recovering mode on this thing. There's a bunch of us here that's indicating that that's really true. But desire's not enough. You know, if we ride flying along in an airplane and John Butcher's the pilot, and I'm flying along with him, you know, we're up there and just two of us, and he knows how to fly an airplane and I don't. Well, we're just happy and flying, talking AA, and John just dies. Brother, I'm going to be motivated to fly that airplane. My desire to change is going to be strong. But that doesn't give me the skills to accomplish it. I am not skillful at managing my life under those circumstances. What I need is a coping mechanism. I need somebody to very quickly teach me how to deal with that situation. My motivation is unquestionable. My skills are lacking. I think that's what I lacked. I didn't know how to stay off of drugs. I didn't know how to cope with my feelings. I didn't know how to cope with life. I know people, it's like this. When you're in junior high school, you know, somebody's mother dies, you don't know what to say to them. You don't know how to, you know, you put your hands in your pocket and your toe in the sand and you're going, golly, you know, hi. You know, you don't know what to say. Same thing, when we're our size, driving down the street, right? you have a flat tire. Now, you know, and you've had patients like, you know that if you don't get to work, you're going to get fired. This is the eighth time you're going to be late. And they done told you, if you're late one more time, they're going to fire you. If they fire you, you can't make any money. The court's going to take your kids away and put them in a foster home. Right? All kinds of neat things are going to happen. You have a flat tire. You don't know what to do. You don't know who to call. You call your mama. She done told you 20 times, don't ever call me, girl. You know, you can't call in work. You done gave them your grandma's story. And they ain't going to listen to nothing you tell them. So, well, there's a convenience store. So what do? Well, you go buy a bottle of beer and call the Coke connection. Man, that'll fix it. A lot of time. I think we get drunk, not because we're sorry and no good. We just don't know how to act. We just don't know what to do. We just don't know how to deal with our feelings. We don't even know what our feelings are a lot of times. We're feeling something, and you know what we've been doing? We've been, they say that we're emotionally immature. What I think we are is coping mechanism immature. We don't know what to do with our feelings. And what happens is, through the years when we've had feelings, we copped out. We took a drink. We call that a coping mechanism. That's not a coping mechanism. It doesn't cope with nothing. You married somebody with a great big old hog jaws, and he's going, you know, right? And you get drunk. You don't change him. He's still got hog jaws. You just don't give a damn anymore. So you really haven't coped. All you've done is got through the day. That thing come to AA, and here we are, we haven't been coping all these years. Well, AA says resentment is number one offender. Resentment, I guess, is frozen anger. To relive again, to feel again what we... You know, somebody can call you an SOB 20 years ago, and if you don't get some resolution on that thing, 20 years from now, every time you think about it, you can get angry again. You feel exactly the way you felt the day he called you that. Now... Thing is, him calling you, that's not making you mad anymore. It's the memory of him calling you that's making you mad. What we don't have is a way to get a healing of our memories. We don't know how to cope with a painful memory. We don't know how to deal with resentments. If I could get... And so, through the years, let's say that every day of my life, I got mad two or three times. And I finally get to AA and I sober up. Well, hell, I can't hardly think about anything that I won't... I mean, all my memories are angry, right? And here I am, and I'm sitting on a hospital bed, and I'm just seething. Well, I got all those memories of all those angry situations. I never resolved. And guilt's a big one, too. Oh, I'm sorry, no good. Boy, have you ever... You know what that makes you feel? It's going to be that way forever. I'm always going to be this way. It's always been that way. And I have never known how to deal with it. So what frame of reference am I going to have? The only way I've ever been able to not hurt and not feel anything is to change it with a psychotropic chemical. I didn't know that there was a way to change it without using a psychotropic chemical. And so when I get angry or when I get fearful or when I get anything, tremendous fear in all of us, tremendous sense of vulnerability. You know, through the years, we've been using drugs over and over and over again. Those things screw up your mind. And pretty soon your mind is full of all kinds of weird thoughts that are not based on reality. We're weird. I think what we have is having a bunch of character defects. I think everybody's got character defects. We got any Al-Anons in here? Y'all got any character defects? Yeah. People have character defects whether you're an alcoholic or not. Thing about it is, these folks learn some coping mechanisms that do them pretty good, and they don't have to go get drunk over it. If we weren't susceptible to alcohol and so forth, we wouldn't be such bad folks. I don't think. We could learn some coping mechanisms. Don't we do that? You know, some of the neatest people I know are sobered up alcoholics. I have a concept I call weller than well. Years ago, I guess Freud and some of the other folks, maybe all of us, thought that when you were mentally ill, that when you got well, you got normal. Well... You know, normal is not normal. Normal is average. So if average is in the middle, and there are a lot of people who are below average, there's an equal number of people who are above average. Maslow found out that there were 4-5% of our population who were beautiful, wonderful, self-actualizing people who had actualized the tremendous potential that humans have to be fully human. You know, we got a lot of negative attributes, all kinds of things, jealousy and envy and all kinds of things, fear. We have exactly the same potential smoldering in us for joy and peace. You know what peace is? That ain't peace and goodwill towards men. Peace is feeling secure rather than insecure. Now that's peace. We got the potential to have that, but we just haven't actualized it. Well, Maslow says that 4-5% of the people in the world actualize. You know, we have a whole gamut for positive things. Just as many, it's like having two legs, we just walk on one of them. We haven't learned to make the other one work. They're in us. All we got to do is learn to actualize them. Well, what I think happens is, among alcoholics, I think our program of recovery forces us to begin to actualize the human attributes for beauty and positive, and promotes a personal growth. You know, one of the reasons we stay mad at people so much is because we don't know how to, we don't know what to say to them when we're mad. We don't know how to resolve that thing. You learn to do that in AA. You learn to dwell on God when things are bad instead of, you know, joy is a state of mind that comes from knowing that maybe God can help you or something. Well, you can induce that with a chemical. We call it euphoria. But you can learn to do it without using a chemical. I hate to be condemned to a chemical to experience joy. That's a human privilege. Anyway, I think that our recovery program leads us into a lifestyle that promotes an existence that's above average. Almost everybody in here has been in the program very long. We're not living average lifestyles. You're exemplary people. You love God more than most. You're more honest than most. You're more persevering than most. You're more excited than most. You're more enthusiastic. You know what enthos is? That's a Greek, I guess, Tony. Greek for God. Enthusiasm. Have you ever seen a more enthusiastic group of people in your life? Never. I never have. This is a wonderful, fantastic, self-actualizing group of people sitting here. Some of the brightest minds in the world, folks, you're among. You know, you have to be sorry, no good to catch what we catch. I've just told you, some of the brightest, Dr. Luke told us last night about some of the most exquisitely trained minds and some of the best people in the world, physicians and doctors of all kinds, catch our disease. I think among the last 10 Nobel Prize winners, about 8 of them were alcoholics or Pulitzer Prize winners. Some of our athletes, some of our most capable, most revered athletes become addicted to drugs. Some of our most sensitive and beautiful artists in the performing arts become addicted. Some of our highest statesmen, you know, we had Wilbur M. here, the wife of one of our presidents, the brother of another one of our presidents, the nephew of another one of our presidents. Those are the ones we know about. These, I guess, are some of the highest people in the land. That's questionable. Depends on whether you're Democratic or Republican. But I believe it's spread across the lines. Nearly anybody can catch it. One of our own members, Dr. Buzz A., was near the original astronauts. You know, they test astronauts with every test there is for human excellence. And he passed them with flying colors or he wouldn't have been an astronaut. And yet he became an alcoholic. You don't have to be sorry and no good. Dr. Valiant said that there wasn't any pre-morbid pathology probably. There is pre-morbid susceptibility, but not pathology all the time. Now, I know a lot of us hurt. A lot of us had a lot of emotional turmoil and a lot of character defects, but I don't think that's a condition restricted to alcoholics. What happens is we learn to use alcohol and drugs to resolve them or to try to resolve them. Plus, we got a chemical allergy to the damn stuff. If them social drinkers, if they had a chemical allergy, I guess they'd catch it too. I don't know how they get away with what they do. I don't know how anybody, a human, who is susceptible to addicting chemicals, I don't know how any human can take addicting chemicals and not get hooked on them. I don't understand that. I think they're weird, don't you? I really think one of these days, 100,000 years now, anthropologists will be saying the alcoholics were the real people. Them other dudes were weird. I think one of the things that leads to a slip is low self-esteem and the depression and the fear and the anger that goes with it. I don't want you to ever have a slip. I want you to leave out here thinking you are as good as anybody and better than most. Evidence that we are, that because we're alcoholics makes us sorry and no good is not true. Big book in the chapter, There's a Solution, talks about the fact that when we're drinking, our disposition and our personality resembles our true nature but little. He says he may be well balanced and just perfectly capable in every area except in the area of drugs. He has trouble. The insanity, I think, that we have is the insanity that comes from beginning to believe that addiction is not real for us. We believed that when we started drinking. Did you know that? I guarantee you, nobody ever picked up their first bottle of beer and said, "Hey, I think I'll catch this thing and go on down here to Willing Way 25, 30 years now and get cured and then start going to meetings." Nobody believes that's going to happen to you. There's never been an addict that put a needle in his arm and said, "I think I'll get hooked." Nobody believes they're going to do it. Well, every time you have a slip, that same thing happens. The inability to perceive reality is insanity. And what we do is we decide that one shot won't hurt. That's an insane decision. It's not based on reality. The reality is that if you're an addict, you are an addict by definition. Best thing I ever heard was a pickle can't start being a cucumber again. If you ever make pickle, brother, you can't be by definition, you ain't going to ever be a cucumber. That's the same thing with a virgin. I don't really want to pursue that very much, but once that thing's gone, it's done, you know. Now, I don't mean it couldn't improve, but I think that's the same way with us. Anyway, I practiced veterinary medicine for quite a number of years, and I went to the AA, and I got sober. And I stayed sober for 7.5 years because I met some men in Houston who began to talk to me about God and began to talk to me about the mechanics of working the AA program, learning to deal with my character defects that I had. And by God's grace, somehow I began one day at a time to be able to deal with life as I experienced it on a daily basis without being condemned to the use of drugs. I remember once in my early days, I hadn't been sober very long, and I was having a tremendous anxiety attack, I guess. My anxiety attacked me. And I was driving down the street, and I got the feeling that, my God, if this, I'm going to have to go get me some pills. I loved speed. Y'all love speed? I love speed. I just thought I was going to have to, and I said, God, if this feeling don't go away, I'm going to have to go get something. And about that time, and I didn't believe in God, by the way. I thought that was a hell of a story, but it didn't affect me very much somehow. I thought. Anyway, about that time, a squirrel. I was at a red light, and a squirrel ran across this light wire and ran down. I was watching that squirrel, you know. By the time I left that thing, my feeling had abated a good deal. And it suddenly occurred to me that God had put that squirrel in my vision. And I figured it out. I said, for a veterinarian, what a good way to avert your attention and change your feelings to give you... Because I love animals, right? I love animals. And there was a little lady could have walked in front of me. Well, but that would have made it worse. I started being able to believe in God. I couldn't believe in the virgin birth. By the way, if you don't believe in God, don't start with that one. That's a toughie. Especially for medical people. You know, if y'all are like I am, you're saying, yeah, that gal, she told old Joseph, that was a hell of a story she put on that old boy. By our human nature, we are geared, and the law of life makes us believe in what we can see, feel, touch, and interpret with our physical and materialistic senses. God is an abstraction. Do you know that? God is a word. The Bible said, God, in the beginning, God was a word. God was word, and the word was with man, but it was a word. And that's all it was. Meaning that it was a mental phenomenon. The ability to have the spiritual attributes that the Bible talks about in my personality, joy, peace, love, self-control, gentleness, those attributes, that comes from my ability to abstract about a being. It won't be, the messages won't come to me from physical stimuli. I've got to be able to begin to interpret life from the framework of spiritual instruction. I got to begin to be able to believe that that squirrel is God's action in this world. Those of you that have studied statistics, you ever had to take them statistics courses? I took a bunch of them things. And in statistics, you know that in the laws of probability, that if you have an honest coin and you flip that thing, you don't know which way it's going to turn up, but there ain't but two answers. Then the probabilities are going to be close to 50-50. Probabilities are going to be close to 50-50 every time. Now, in the world, there is no real scientific Koch's principles or any scientific way to prove the existence of God. We can't prove it. Can't prove it. A lot of us believe it. A lot of us have strong beliefs in it and all of that, but we can't prove it to anybody with any scientific measures. Let me tell you a secret. You can't disprove it either with any scientific measures. There ain't no way to say that there ain't no God. Now, the atheists have as strong a faith that there ain't no God as we do that there is one, but that's faith. It's not proof. Faith is the evidence of things not seen. It's the assurance of things hoped for. Faith, if you can see it, that's reality. You don't need faith. Faith is based on something that can't be seen. And the only way you can believe in God is by faith. If you're waiting for proof that there's a God, you can't believe any more on proof because there ain't no proof. You ever know that? Everybody that believes in God by act of faith. You just believe it. Probabilities are exactly equal that there is one or there isn't one. In AA we say, I believe in a power outside of myself that I choose to call God. Okay. Probabilities are the same. If I choose to believe that there's not a God, the probabilities are 50% that I'm going to be right, but they're 50% that I'm going to be wrong. Those turkeys that don't believe in God could be wrong. Now, if I believe in God, the probabilities, talking about science now, probabilities are 50% that I'm right, 50% that I'm wrong, but 50% that I'm right. Since there's no proof, the only way in the world to ever believe in God is by choice. You just make a simple choice to start believing in God. It's your mind. You can believe in anything you want to believe in. You say, I can't believe it. Yes, you can. Just believe it. How do you do that? Well, you just believe it. How come? Because you want to. Do you want to believe in God? Well, I think it'd be neat. You guys seem to be getting a lot out of it, and it's doing this, and it makes life better for y'all, and y'all stay sober and all this and that. I sure wish I could. Well, go ahead. I'll let you. A lot of us say, well, I don't want to get my hopes up in vain. You ever heard anybody say that? You ever had that? I don't want to get my hopes up in vain. Why? Well, because you get your hopes up in vain, you find out you've been wrong, your hopes come crashing down. Well, the way to keep that from happening is keep your hopes crashed down all the time. That way you don't have to go through that exercise, right? Get your hopes up. Let me tell you, there really is a scientific evidence that self-fulfilling prophecy works. Self-fulfilling prophecy is motivated by hope. Start hoping that neat things are going to happen to you. It might turn out to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. If self-fulfilling prophecy actually happens, why not make it positive? Why always prophesy something negative about it? I just know goddamn thing ain't going to work, you know. You don't know that. Not if it hadn't happened yet. Do you know that there ain't nothing happened tomorrow yet? Really hadn't. Anything that's going wrong tomorrow is a mental phenomenon. Did you know that? It may be based on reality or the evidence. Statistical evidence may have brought you to this moment, but all the rest of it's conjecture. And I can conjecture anything I want to, if I want to. Anything I want to, if I want to, is mine to conjecture. It's my mind. Nobody can make me conjecture negativity except me.
I've decided I don't want to do that very much anymore, and I don't do a lot of it. I just ask God to make me quit conjecture and negativity. Sometimes just in thinking about him is a positive thought. Sometimes just in thinking about John Butcher is a positive thought. Sometimes just thinking about IDA is a positive thought. And it can change my mood. It's a wonderful coping device. Just to be able to think about something besides negativity. It changes my feelings. Work good as whiskey. Don't cost near as much money. What happened to me was, I was going to tell you something else. One more thing about this believing in God just because you want to. You get your hopes up and you believe in God by faith. And you go along and you stay sober. You're able to work your job. You get to be the president of CompCare. You know, a lot of beautiful things happen to you because you're able to believe in God. And then you die and it ain't true. What's the worst thing can happen? You never know it. If there ain't no God, right, you ain't going to come to one of these days and say, well, bless Pete, I died, and I believed God all this time, and there wasn't no God. That can't happen. Your hopes will never come crashing down. If you get your hopes up and you make it till you die, it's a win-win proposition. You done love God and got all these beautiful benefits and believed God all this time, and it ain't true, you never know you've been a dunce. You can't. 50% chance of that happening. 50% chance of it being the other way. How many of us would operate on somebody if we could give them a 50% chance? Would you, by faith, go operate on them? How many of us operate on people if we can give them a 5% chance? Give yourself a 50% chance. That's good odds. Do it because you want to. Make a choice. It's that simple. How do you do that? One day at a time. One day at a time. Every day, something tries to steal your belief in God. I still have things stealing my belief in God. Every day. Big Book says every day is a day that we need to take the vision of God's will into our daily life. Every day. Reaffirm it. I believe in you, God. What did the guy say? I believe, oh God, help my disbelief. I need God to help. One of the gifts of the Spirit is faith. You can't have faith without God. The AA says a great reality of the presence of God or the existence of God is to change lives. Friends, we see electricity here being manifested by these incandescent light bulbs, but that's not electricity. That's manifestation of it, and therefore we believe in it. Same thing with gravity. I guess as old Newton saw an apple fall and it went in that direction. He said, I choose to call that gravity. He just gave it a name right there, I guess. Nobody knew what the hell to call it up until then, and now we all call it gravity. But we ain't never seen no gravity. Did you know that? You can measure it. You can measure it, and we call that weight. But, you know, what keeps it from going off in the other direction? The reality that we perceive in that fallen body, and we say that's because of gravity. There's electricity everywhere. I got electricity in my pocket. There's some under some people's skirts, and, you know, and you can think anything you want to there. But... Moving right along, I could think of some things to say about that. But electricity is in my pocket, but it's not being manifested. That don't mean there ain't no electricity here. AA says the great reality of God is in his manifestation. And how could God manifest himself except in human existence? That's the only way. And he does. Beautifully. You just flip a switch and we just burn. We say, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink today through a power that I choose to call God. And it's a power that I never had before, and therefore it must be from outside of myself. Fantastic power in that belief statement. Fantastic power in that. There's a, you know, that talks about the Holy Trinity. He says that God can come and live in you. And you and your personality can blend with the personality of God, and you begin to be empowered by the strength and the guidance and the love and the Spirit of the Holy Spirit. And I become God-like. The Bible says that we can have the mind of Christ. Not the brain of Christ, but the mind of Christ. You know, mind's changeable. We ain't really got a mind anyway. Do you know that, psychiatrist? What we got is a brain. Our mind is a state of consciousness, and it's filled with all kinds of things, all kinds of nuances, and we've put terms to them, feelings and emotions and thoughts and ideas and constructs and definitions and sense of values and all kinds of beliefs. That's my state of consciousness. But that thing can change in a minute. Did you know that? In a minute. It can change from a redhead to a blonde. Just that quick. It can change from walking down the street to needing four donuts, huh, Tony? It can just... I saw a man broke off from a jog yesterday and went and bought a chocolate ice cream cone. He's sitting back there. Your mind can turn from... what we used to say in I was the best horse sack... Y'all excuse this. I'm going to cuss a little bit. We used to say that I was the best psychiatrist in Houston, Texas. I could, in 2 minutes, I could castrate a horse in 2 minutes. I could change his mind from ass to grass in 2 minutes. Hormonal changes was influencing you, but our mind can change from moment to moment. What we have is a problem with the mind, the big book says, coupled with an allergy of the body. We need to develop methods to change our mind to a state of mind that is pleasant and powerful and guiding and all of that. And that's what spirituality is. When God is living in me, He is influencing my mind in a positive direction. And so my mind is filled with feelings of joy and peace and love and inspiration and enthusiasm. My brain hasn't changed much, maybe. Now, it responds to a mental state, too. You know, our body chemistry is going to be influenced by our mental state. But thank God, my mental state can change even before my chemistry changes. Somebody says, "Hey, you're being shot at." And I get frightened. Somebody else says, "No, that was a firecracker." My fear goes away in spite of the chemical change. Just knowledge changes my feelings. So when you can begin to believe that there is a real force available in this world that human beings can tap into that will change our mind, our state of mind, and our character defects begin to come under the influence and under the dominion of God in my life. Oh boy, that's powerful. I love that. I love that. I stayed sober for 7.5 years, got drunk, tried to kill myself again, and just had all kinds of terrible things. If God's still loving me tomorrow, and as I understand Him, He's going to be from now on. How will God's love ever change? Remember the footstep thing? God's going to love me no matter what I... God's love is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow for me, no matter what I do or what I've been. Did you know that? He loved you right in the middle of all that dope shooting. I didn't know that. I thought God was hating me. He wasn't. He loved me. Still loves me. I had this slip. I got back, and I got to quit. It's going to take me 2 minutes to quit. Takes one drink to get drunk and 55-gallon drum sober up on. Takes 50 minutes to tell my story and 2 minutes to get through with it. What happened to me was I had this slip. I came back to IDAA, and I've already told you this. I went back to school, and I studied some behavioral medicine, and my wife and I have our own counseling center now. I'm very, very grateful for that. I haven't had a drink. I had heart surgery about 15 months ago. I ran 13 and a half miles on my 12-month post-surgical birthday. I believe they fixed me. Medicine really does work. So does surgery. So is God, but surgery works. Boy, they just fixed that thing up, and I'm most blessed. The doctors came out of the surgery after 3 hours to talk to my wife. She says, "Well, how'd it go?" They said, "Well, we hadn't really opened him up yet. We've been looking for enough veins to fix him." The veins in my legs were gone, guys, because I put needles all up and down. They finally got up to right where our fork. and they found enough to fix me with. Praise God. I finally had a the sequelae of dope fiendism can be more than just being sorry and no good. You ain't got no veins to fix your heart with. So I went through that thing, and I gave me some drugs, and I didn't get readdicted. I don't think I have to worry about getting readdicted today. As long as I believe in God and use His tremendous power in my life, Can I tell that story about Homer? Or had I better quit? Better quit. I meant to tell that story. He's overruled, Democratic rule. I was here at an IDAA meeting about 6 or 7 years ago, and I was telling a story about the tremendous relief that I'd gotten from a prayer one time. So after the meeting, there was a guy slipped up to me, and he said, "Roger, I want to talk to you." And I went to his room with him, and he says, "I heard what you said about this prayer business." He said, "I've been on Demerol," and he said, "I'm scared to death." He was 8 days into a detox. He said, "I'm scared to death." He said, "I think I'm going to die, and I'm going to get malpractice, and I don't know what all is going to happen to me." He said, "Would you pray with me?" And I gulped. You know, I wasn't, I wasn't in the business of praying with people, and I wasn't sure I could do it, and I wasn't sure that God would come through for me. You know, my reputation was at stake here. And I said, "Okay, I'll pray with you," and we prayed, and then I left. That was, I guess, on Saturday night. On Sunday morning, this guy got up. His name was Homer. Homer got up. He said, "Well, he wasn't very cocky. He says, "Well, last night I asked Cadwalder to go to my room with me, and we prayed. He told about how prayer had helped him. Prayer has helped me, guy. Prayer has helped me." And he says, "I asked him to pray with me, and said he prayed with me, and nothing happened. That's what I was scared of. Nothing happened." He said, he started to leave the room, and I asked him, said, "What'll I do if I get scared again?" I guess he wasn't scared at that moment. Something happened. We counseled a long time. And he said, "Cadwalder told me that if I got scared again, to go pray. Every time I got scared, go pray." He said, "About 2 o'clock in the morning, I woke up just terrified, and I went to the window, and I knelt down, and I started praying. And by now he was crying, and about half of us was crying. And he said that I was praying, and Jesus knelt down beside me and put his arm on my shoulder and said, "Homer," and this is what he said. He said, "I've always hated my name. Homer was the ugliest name I ever heard until Jesus said it, and then it wasn't ugly." And he said, he told me, "Homer, if I get off that cross, you can get off that Demerol." And I just asked Luke, and I've asked some other people here. I kept tabs on him up until 2 years ago. We know that Homer was doing beautifully. He went back into practice. He got a new wife. The way he got on Demerol was his wife died, bless his heart. Never took anything in his life. He was a 55-year-old man. And you don't have to be sorry no good to catch this thing. He caught it. Thank God. He got over it. Right there. Right there. Something happened. I don't know. God may not be. But I got a 50% chance of being right if I believe it. Plus, I have all this evidence that if I want to choose to become conscious that this is God working in my life, seek to improve my conscious contact, my awareness that God is reality in other people's lives, it begins to work for me. I'm sorry I talked too long. God bless you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Roger. It's sure good to hear you again. We're running late. I think we better close. Those of you would, we stand and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Our temptation. Deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, power, and glory.